Good morning, Your Honors. Elizabeth Newman for Mr. Bohorquez. Your Honors, the government's brief contends that Mr. Bohorquez was not eligible for 212C relief, and we concede that that's correct on further reflection. But that doesn't change that he was eligible for adjustment of status, just as we say in our brief and just as we argued below. Now, on appeal, the government has turned the adjustment of status issue into an issue about visa availability. And for the government on appeal, that's almost all that this case is really about. But they never mentioned visa availability below. They never litigated it below. They never mentioned it in their briefing. They never mentioned it in argument in the district court. And now they're asking this court to take judicial notice of some facts to support an argument that they never made below. We submit, Your Honors, that you shouldn't let them do that. We never got a chance to address their facts or their argument below because they never raised it. The district court never passed on it because they never raised it. And if they had raised it below, we could have addressed it factually. We can address it factually in a rather sketchy way now.
Well, how do you address it now? In other words, that is one of the elements, right, of adjustment of status?
That is one of the elements. Well, yes, Your Honor, that is one of the statutory elements of adjustment of status. But if we were to litigate it now, well, our position, Your Honor, is that remand is required in any case because the district court never passed on the prejudice issue. But the remand should be limited to a finding on the prejudice issue. However, if the court does take judicial notice of the visa availability, the visa bulletin, here's more or less what we perhaps what we could say. We could say that the evidence could show that the visa availability issue is a non-issue because Mr. Bohorquez's life partner, Ms. Esquivel, was at that time of his deportation hearing a lawful permanent resident in the process of becoming a citizen. And she could have become a citizen. The record evidence shows she was in the process and wanted to, and he could have married her. And if he had done that, he would have had a visa immediately available without any waiting because he would have been the husband of a U.S. citizen under 1151B2A1. We never got a chance to put in that evidence, and we could put in something like that on remand. But what's really required as far as remand is concerned is a remand limited to the prejudice issue because the government never litigated that below, and it's trying now to litigate it for the first time on appeal. And without the visa bulletin documents, the government has nothing. It can't deny that Mr. Bohorquez should have been told that he was apparently eligible for this relief of adjustment of status and that he wasn't told of this relief for adjustment of status. And that's the only focus of the district court's inquiry, and the district court's inquiry really ought to end there. I would like to turn.
Didn't he actually need both forms of relief? Relief under two? Potentially need both forms of relief? Relief under
12C?
12C and adjustment of status?
No, Your Honor. That was an incorrect legal analysis on our part. He did not need 212C relief because a weapons offense is not a crime of moral turpitude, as the government correctly points out.
Would adjustment of status grant him all the relief he needed?
Yes, it would. What it would do is cleanse him of the weapons offense, mm-hmm. so that he could fictionally reenter the country as
right.
someone cleansed of that.
It's a matter of fiction.
Exactly, but that's all. That is all he
that's
needed.
All he needed was adjustment of status.
Yes, that's all he needed. He didn't need the 212C relief at all. The government's other.
Well, how do you? I'm still having a hard time. Is there another way to look at immediately? A visa is immediately available. What does that mean?
Well, Your Honor, I know I'm on a little bit of thin ice with this panel talking about the Hernandez case.
I struggled with that in the Hernandez case. We spent hours and days trying to figure out
what that meant. Well, here's how I would.
We gave it our best shot. But that was different facts.
Different facts.
Yeah, she already had. She was married and already had.
Well, it was
approved a long time before.
Well, it was different procedurally as well, Your Honor, because the way I think Hernandez can be reconciled with Bowie is to say that in Hernandez what the court was saying was if she needed it, she already had it, and not she needed it. But if she needed it, she satisfied that
right,
requirement.
And the government didn't fight that.
Whereas in Bowie, the issue was a little bit different. There the court said, yes, this young man should have been told of his apparent eligibility for 212H relief, which included an adjustment of status, which included an adjustment of status petition. And if there were these theoretical roadblocks, as I think the court called it, as to immediate availability, well, that's something that the IJ should consider on remand. Now, we're not saying that you should remand this case so that Judge Letts can consider it on remand, because Bowie is procedurally very distinct from this case, because Bowie involves an IJ deciding whether to grant relief, either initially or on remand. But our case is at a different level. Here we're in the district court asking whether the IJ could plausibly have decided to grant relief. So we're one level removed. So the standard is different. It's only whether Mr. Bohorquez was informed of his apparent eligibility for this relief, and if not, whether the defect prejudiced him. And so I don't think that the court actually even really has to address the issue, of whether the visa availability is an absolute requirement. But if it, because we're at this different level, and the government's not, the government's raising it only in this context and not somewhere else in the defect and prejudice analysis. But if the court does decide that it is necessary, then it shouldn't take judicial notice of the visa bulletins. And if it does take judicial notice of the visa bulletins and remands, then we can present this evidence about an immediate visa available to him as the husband of someone who was in the process of becoming a U.S. citizen.
Okay.
I'd like to turn to the prejudice issue, because for the government, that's really the only other live issue in the case, it seems.
When this was going on, they were not married.
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
When this was going on, they were not married.
They were not married. They have since done so. And she was in process of becoming a citizen. They're still married. They have two children. And she visits him in Mexico every other weekend. So, I mean, this is a live and viable marriage. And
she's still married. If they're married and they have two children, why can't he go to American, consul general near the border and get a visa?
Because he's been deported, Your Honor. At least that's my understanding of the state of immigration law. That what we're trying to do here today is undo the criminal conviction,
that keeps him down there.
Right. Which
so he doesn't get priority on the visa.
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
So are they married now?
Yes.
And they got married when?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. The record evidence doesn't show it. But turning briefly to the prejudice issue, the government says that we have to show outstanding equities, and I would dispute that. What we have to show is that there was a plausible ground, a plausible reason to believe we could show outstanding equities to an IJ, so it's a different, more attenuated analysis. And there is an INS case, a BIA case, that shows that two of the factors in our case are outstanding equities, and they are the length of residence here in the United States, despite the fact that much of that was without legal status, and his family life, his family ties, his partner, children, parents, grandparents, siblings, all of them here. That case is a matter of Rodarte Espinoza. 21 INN DEC 150. It's a BIA case from 1995. And so I would like to bring that to the Court's attention. It's our position, of course, that the district court never passed on the prejudice issue in the first instance, but if this court decides that in some way it did, it should find that the district court erred in its prejudice analysis, and that we have met the prejudice burden. I would like to save any remaining time for rebuttal, Your Honors. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Eric Silber on behalf of the United States. Defendant argues that it's improper in this circumstance to take judicial notice of the visa bulletin, and the government respectfully submits that it's not the government's burden in this case, nor was it in the district court, to show the defendant was eligible immediately for a visa. It was defendant's burden to show that a visa was immediately available.
You never raised that as a ground, to deny eligibility. They do in the district court?
That is correct, although...
I mean, why should the defendant have to contest a ground that wasn't raised?
Well, 2 points, I think, that are relevant. First, given that it's the defendant who's claiming a right to relief under Section 245 of the Immigration and Nationality Act, it's defendant's burden to show the entitlement. And it's not up to the government to have to raise the lack of entitlement in that circumstance. I mean, this Court routinely affirms...
Well, once you decided to raise it, you should have raised it in the district court.
Yeah, then why are you raising it now? Yeah. Not, you don't have to raise it.
Well, I mean, I think it is an absolute bar in this circumstance. I note on the issue of the opportunity to contest this in the district court, defendant's own expert at ER 32 indicated that the defendant was taking preference as a family preference 2B, which is the same preference.
Who indicated that?
That's defendant's expert. If you look at excerpt of record, page 32.
Well, I mean, just like you, he's changing the record.
Well, but the only argument that's been raised here regarding that is that the defendant could have got married for immigration purposes, which is not a permissible basis to get a visa. I mean, if that had been done, it would have...
I don't think she said for immigration purposes. She said it's a long-standing relationship, and she just said they could have gotten married.
You got two kids.
Well, they do now, but at the time, first of all, there's nothing in the record to say they, in fact, have been married, and I do think that's important because even at the time of the hearing, there was no evidence of that. But you have to look back that this deportation happened 9 years ago in 1995. At that time, they had really, the record suggests, met only about a year before that. She was pregnant with the first child but had not had any children at that point. And the argument that was raised in the district court, because this point was made in the district court, that one of the IJ's failures was to not advise him to marry this individual who he was dating at the time. And that's just not a permissible basis to adjust the status, to get a visa based upon that. I mean, it would have been done in this context solely for immigration purposes. The only basis on this record in which the defendant, and I think backing up, by the way, I mean, we pointed this out in our brief, that even if he did do that at the time of the deportation hearing, she was a permanent resident. And so even as a 2A preference category, he was not eligible at the time, and he remains not eligible under a 2A category. I mean, those are the issues that we face. You have to look at the time of the hearing whether the defendant was eligible. I mean, the wording of Section 245 and 8 CFR 245.1G is it has to be immediately available. And at the hearing, there was no visa available to this individual. And again, it's defendant's burden to establish that. In Gonzalez-Valerio, this court indicated there the defendant...
In other words, your position is this on that issue, even if what Ms. Newman says is can be supported by evidence, in other words, that, he could have gotten married. That's not enough because he wasn't married? Is that what you're saying?
It's two prongs. First, if he had got married simply for immigration purposes, you couldn't use that to adjust your status. You couldn't use that relationship, which is what he's saying should have happened at that hearing. Secondly, even if he had got married, his spouse would have been a legal permanent resident alien. So his preference category would have been 2A. And in...
Under the family one, it's 2B?
And when he, if he takes it from his parents as an adult son, it would be 2B. But I think it's important to note that the 2A date that was in December 1995 was February 22nd, 1992, 3 years before the hearing. And again, as of today, it still has not reached the hearing date. 9 years after the hearing, it's only up to September 15th, 1997.
What is? Which one?
For the 2A preference 2A. Category, right. Which is what he's saying. I mean, again, they're saying, they are suggesting that, well, his wife could have become a citizen down the road, and then he could have claimed it as a spouse of a citizen. But, I mean, you have to really look at the time of the hearing. It was undisputed at the time of the hearing that his, at that time, significant other was an LPR. And it would,
what you're saying is, even if the defendant could have shown that, you know, he would have been eligible as the spouse of a permanent resident, a visa would not have been immediately available.
Yes, and there was, given the backlog from Mexico, there was no hope of that happening in the near future.
Is that also in the visa bulletin?
Yes, it is.
You could get a visa bulletin that shows that?
Well, we, the document we had to put in the record had the 2A preference category listed in it as well. And I think we noted in our brief that we didn't believe he would be eligible as 2A in any event. And we also.
What's your argument on the plausible showing or the prejudice?
Well, I do think that outstanding equities, I don't believe defense counsel is contesting that outstanding equities are required. Just simply in the context, you only have to show plausible grounds. But, I mean, I think in the context of outstanding equities that that's difficult to do. As the First Circuit indicated in Chen, unfortunately, a number of grounds that you see, like length of residence, family in the United States, employment, home ownership, things like that are kind of garden variety equities. And this court indicated the same in Gonzalez-Valerio. Now, the court didn't absolutely hold that in Gonzalez-Valerio. It just pointed to the facts here and said, this court and other courts have rejected showings that are much stronger than this. But I think in that context, it's important to recognize both the seriousness of defendant's offense and the nature of the factors the defendant cites. Turning first to the seriousness of the offense, it's important to judge this in the context of Section 245. I mean, it is true in Rashtabadi, this court indicated that you look at the 212C factors, the matter of Marin factors, when making the determination under adjustment of status. But it's also important to recognize that unlike 212C consideration, which only applies to people who are deportable, many people who apply for adjustment of status have done nothing wrong. That's simply their way of getting legal permanent resident status. I mean, you're talking people who have no criminal background, nothing that disqualifies them from entry in the United States. So when you're looking in that context, defendant's very serious criminal conduct in this case takes on a much more significant role. And I think the BIA has indicated.
I forget what his conviction
was. He was convicted.
Been convicted for.
He was convicted on one count of assault with a firearm, and he was charged with a second count as well. I mean, you have two instances of assault with a firearm that were part of the same criminal case.
What were the facts?
The PSR does not indicate any facts other than it was two different individuals that he assaulted in this circumstance.
I don't know what that means.
Well, I think the
did he shoot people or did he wound them?
Just wave the gun.
Well, I mean, I think by necessity to get convicted of assault, you would have to have reasonably put them in fear in that circumstance rather than just having the.
I don't know.
I'm not sure the answer to that. I mean, I do think.
No, we're just sort of in the dark about what happened.
I think the important thing to recognize is regardless of.
You might have just come in there and pled, huh?
Well, but I think he can't, in the immigration context, challenge his conviction. So, I mean, he is he can't go before the BIA or IJ and say, well, I didn't do the facts or, the, you know, it was I didn't do what I pled guilty to because the IJ or the BIA has no authority as an administrative agency to question a state conviction.
Well, in balancing the equities, can't they look at the underlying circumstances?
I think they can look at the underlying circumstance, but I think it's important to recognize in the context of this case, this is a conviction, this firearm conviction, that the Congress has treated very seriously. In fact, so seriously that there is no grounds for deportation, really from deportation in this context. And the only way that the defendant is even eligible for this is through the adjustment of status remedy, which in some ways thwarts Congress's intent, which the IJ would have been able to weigh here. I mean, this was a very serious offense by Congress's definition because it involved a firearm, and firearm offenses, as Congress has defined in the statute, are...
How old was he when he was convicted of this offense?
I believe he was 24. Give me a moment, Your Honor.
And at that time, how long had he been in the country?
I believe he entered approximately 1971. I believe the date of the offense the date of conviction was 2/24/92. So he'd been in the country approximately 21 years.
And he had several children?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that fact. I mean, I was focusing on the conviction for a second, but...
He had several children, didn't he?
Well, but I think we have to look at the nature of that. He had two children at the time, right. But the PS...
And this other woman was pregnant. Well, no, that came later.
She was pregnant at the time of the deportation hearing. But I think... Focusing first on the two children that he had with his ex-wife, the PSR indicates at paragraph 21... that his wife had left the United States with the two children by the time of the deportation hearing. And, in fact, the defendant indicates that that's why he didn't really contest the deportation charges, because he had a hopelessness of seeing the kids again. Well, if the kids are not in the United States, they do not support granting adjustment of status. It can't really be considered a significant equity. I mean, at the time, they were living in Panama, which does not aid his case here.
Do we know why they were living in Panama?
Doesn't indicate in the PSR. And again, looking to the nature of the relationship he had with
his wife from Panama,
it doesn't say in the PSR. It just indicates that she took the children to Panama, and he had kind of a hopelessness around that situation. There's no further explanation in the record regarding that.
Where was he from?
I believe he is from Mexico. And so I think that again, it's recognizing that it's outstanding equities that are required. That downplays that a little bit. Turning to his significant other that he had begun dating, we point out in our brief he only began dating her after immigration proceedings, or at least around the same time immigration proceedings were commenced against him, which significantly downplays the significance of that factor.
Why? Love knows no barriers.
That is true, but it is traditionally that factors that come into play after you immigration consequences have attached are entitled to diminished weight. And I don't think it's not that his love is entitled to diminished weight. It's simply given the context of the deportation proceedings, this particular fact in the outstanding equities inquiry is entitled to diminished weight. And I mean, it's important to recognize. I see that I'm over my time. It is important to recognize that it is outstanding equities. And so, I mean, it really is important to establish not just that you had facts like family here, but that they rise above, significantly above, kind of the other cases. I mean, Ayala Chavez, for example, which this court cited in Gonzalez-Valerio as one of kind of the examples in which it had been denied. I mean, there you had someone who had family here, had a child, had been an LPR for 18 years, had arrived in the United States at age 9, and that was substantial equity, but not outstanding. And I think it's in the context of the difficult burden the defendant faces, these kind of factors that diminish the family circumstances that were present here make it...
But what about this concept of family values that we hear a lot about? Keeping families together.
Well, I mean, I think that's certainly...
Family is, is the basis of our civilized society. We hear this every day, don't we?
And I think that this process and...
We hear it from the Attorney General, don't we?
I think that's right. And I think this process recognizes that. I mean, part of the reason that it allows this kind of discretionary relief is to allow kind of families to stay together. But it does require the kind of equities to be... outstanding when you have the serious criminal offense. I mean, it was defendant's crime that put him in the situation that he's in now. I mean, that's what triggered the deportation and triggered him having to come up.
Yeah, but if we're going to balance equities and we don't even know what the facts are that surrounded this offense, how are we going to do that?
Well, I mean, I think it's important. I mean, as I indicated, the defendant can't really challenge his offense, but to the extent defendant wanted to come forward with some reason why the firearm offense was different than kind of other firearm offenses. I mean, it's defendant's burden to establish the plausible grounds. So to the extent defendant didn't do
that. I want to ask you just two minor questions. One, I gather your position is, just to sum it all up, is that you probably would agree with the defendant that at the hearing, based on what the IJ knew, he should have advised the petitioner that he could apply for relief under, or he'd apply for adjustment of status.
I think that's probably right. I mean, it's a little circular.
So your whole argument really focuses on the prejudice prong. And
well, it's somewhat circular because, I mean, I would expect an immigration judge to know that Mexico is a backlog country and therefore that he would not, in fact, be able to adjust his status. So to some extent, it is circular because the fact that he's not able to get a visa immediately suggests that no notice would be required in that circumstance because there's really no. Exactly. So, I mean, to some extent.
Let me ask you this. Did the INS ever have a practice where they would let the application sort of sit for a while until visas became available?
No, and in fact, it's just the opposite. 8 CFR 245.282 mm-hmm. indicates that they will not accept the application for adjustment of status if a visa is not immediately available.
So who does the petitioner file the visa with? With the IJ or with the INS?
I believe you have to. I actually believe it's with the State Department, although I could be wrong about. I mean, ultimately, it's the State Department. I believe that issues the visa, not the INS. Once he became available, once a visa.
So let's just make sure I understand. So if the IJ had told him, you have the right to apply for adjustment of status. Is that something you want to pursue? Then I gather the IJ would have continued the hearing and allowed him to submit an application.
I think that theoretically could happen. I think it's important to recognize that under the statutes 242.13, you really can only have a reasonable adjournment of the proceedings. And given that 9 years later, it still hasn't reached even close to his kind of eligibility date. Mm-hmm. I mean, essentially what defendant would be asking is for an indefinite suspension of deportation proceedings. I mean, I do think the Second Circuit in Drax indicated that a short adjournment of the proceedings would be appropriate. And there it was 15 months. The defendant's appeal, if in the normal course of things, wouldn't have even been decided by the time he was eligible. I think this court has indicated the same thing in Maturo, this court said, quote, both the special inquiry officer and the Board of Immigration Appeals denied his motion because he was statutorily ineligible as there were no immigrant visas immediately available or likely to become so in the near future. We agree. And, I mean, I do think there's a suggestion if one is about to become available, okay. Maybe you could add, you would need to advise about the right and you need to, get this continuance, go do these things. But that's simply not the case here because, unfortunately, Mexico is a very backlog country, and there really was no hope of getting this either at the time of the hearing or any kind of reasonable time.
Well, I thought that if an illegal alien married an American citizen, that alien was immediately eligible for a visa, and that all I had to do was to leave the country, go to a port of entry, not Tijuana, but there's another one, I forget the name, and just apply for it, and you could get it like that, and then come back in.
Well, I do believe as a spouse of a citizen, he would be exempt from the visa immediate visa requirement. But I think there's two problems ordinarily. There's two problems with that.
If they're a spouse of a citizen, they go down to get the visa. Don't they just get it right away?
Well, he couldn't do that in this context because he was in a deportation proceeding. He could have applied.
I'm asking you generally. I'm just.
I believe generally he could have filed an adjustment of status. He wouldn't have had to leave the country. He could have filed an adjustment of status based on a request to adjust status based on the relationship with his wife. If he were not in deportation proceedings, he could simply have filed that. With the what was then the INS.
But if he crossed the border and then gone to the consul, American consulate in Mexico at the border, he'd have gotten a visa.
Well, I think he could have done that as well. I mean, But the problem is that once he was not married at the – there were two problems as far as the time of his deportation. One was that he was not married, and the second was the person he had begun dating at that time was not a U.S. citizen. She was an LPR. And once deportation proceedings started, there is a presumption that you cannot adjust based on marriage to a U.S. citizen, and you have to show it's for good faith and not for immigration purposes. And I don't think that this record establishes that. In fact, quite the contrary.
Marriage to a U.S. citizen or an LPR?
A U.S. citizen. I apologize if I was unclear about that. It is marriage to a U.S. citizen, which well, I think – let me back up. It's actually – what triggers this requirement in a deportation proceeding is marriage, period, adjustment based upon marriage. It's relevant to this inquiry because citizenship gets – marriage to a citizen gets you more rights than marriage to an LPR does. But ultimately, if you get married in a deportation proceedings, there's essentially a presumption that it's done for immigration purposes. And so you really have to show good faith, and you have to show it was not done for immigration purposes. Now, on this record, there's no showing of that. I mean, there's no even showing that he ever got married to the individual, even at the time, 7 years later, that this was done in the district court, which I think belies the suggestion it would be done for anything but immigration purposes. And in fact, they were not married. I mean, the only reason he would be doing it, as he states, is to adjust his status, which would bar the relief. If the panel has no further questions, the government would submit.
Thank you.
Your Honors, the government's argument shows the necessity for a remand in this case because it points out what's not in the record, what was never, what the defense was never given a chance to develop in the record because the government never raised the visa availability issue ever, not once, below. But to address the sort of thing that might be put into the record on a remand, first of all, the government is incorrect in saying that Ms. Esquivel was pregnant with a first child at the time of Mr. Bohorquez's deportation hearing. She had already given birth to a first child, and she was pregnant with a second child. He tells the immigration judge himself that his children are 7, 9, and 4, and that his girlfriend is pregnant. He had two children with his first wife. He was divorced from her. And so the youngest of his existing children at that time was his first child with Ms. Esquivel.
But he wasn't married at that time.
He was not married at that time. However, she was an LPR, as the government says, and the only evidence in the record, I mean, the evidence in the record does establish that she was in the process of becoming a citizen at the time of his deportation hearing. The government has said rather a lot about the presumption surrounding a marriage that's contracted during the pendency of deportation proceedings, but that presumption is rebuttable, among other things, by the fact of the birth of children, which shows the legitimacy of the relationship. And the case law says that as long as the marriage is based on an actual...
There's nothing to rebut because there's no marriage.
No, Your Honor, you're right. But had he been adequately advised during his deportation hearing that this was a ground of relief, and had he understood that these were the statutory requirements for getting relief, then he could have taken all of these other steps. He could have married her.
The next day,
they had a child already. Another was on the way. He would have immediately been eligible for a visa under 1251B2A1. Furthermore, it's simply not the case that the IJ couldn't have or wouldn't have.
A long line for that visa.
No, Your Honor, that's the visa that's immediately available as the spouse of a U.S. citizen.
Oh, I see, but she wasn't a citizen.
She wasn't, but the IJ could easily have put the hearing over. That very commonly happened, as Your Honor suggested, when Your Honor, she was in the process of becoming a citizen. We don't know how long.
How long was the waiting line for the visa?
Your Honor, the visa that I'm talking about, would have been no waiting line for.
If they had been married. But
if they had been married.
When did she become a citizen?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. There's no evidence in the record about it, and I don't have any outside evidence about that either. I'm sorry. But she was, what the evidence in the record does show from his declaration that was submitted to the district court was that she was in the process of becoming a citizen.
You asked your client when his wife became a citizen?
Your Honor, I don't know when she became a citizen. I'm sorry.
Let me ask a little different question. Following up on what the Judge Ferguson asked Mr. Silber, you put anything in the record, you know, to sort of ameliorate the effect of these firearms assault convictions? there's some way to some argument you can make it that it's not as bad as it might appear on the face of it?
I don't have any other evidence or any other facts to adduce other than what's in the PSR, which just shows a bare fact of assault with, you know, of assault with a firearm, the conviction. But I think the government is incorrect in saying that a firearms conviction is such a serious and terrible thing that the BIA makes it a deportable offense and not an excludable offense.
The BIA, isn't it Congress did
that? I'm sorry, the Congress did that. Because the BIA accepts that you can cleanse yourself of the taint of a firearms offense through adjustment of status. That's normal for the BIA. It's done so before. Matter of Rainford, I believe, is the case that we cited in our briefs. And there are a lot of factors that would weigh in favor of a discretionary.
Did you put any of those factors into the record in favor of this alien?
There are factors in the record, yes, Your Honor.
That go to the assault with the firearm conviction.
Ah, no, Your Honor, only that balance out any taint that might arise from the assault with the firearm conviction. His length of time in the country, although the First Circuit may think that these factors are garden variety, this circuit has taken a different view. In Jimenez-Marmolejo, Piatas Galan, 24-year residence, a 20-year residence. That's what we had in this case. This is a person who came to this country at the age of one, and at the time of his deportation hearing was 25 years old. So he had lived here just as long. And it doesn't matter that some of that time was spent without documents. His family was here, his life partner, children, brothers and sisters, parents and grandparents. Jimenez-Marmolejo says that's important. Ubaldo Figueroa says that's a substantial family tie, a substantial factor, a weighty factor. Piatas Galan says that as well. These are outstanding equities in this circuit. He'd also been here since a very early age. Jimenez-Marmolejo says that's very important. His work history is something that did not exist in Gonzales Valerio. He'd worked since the age of 16 to support his parents, his wife, his partner, and his children. There's no record of public assistance. Ubaldo talks about gainful employment. Piatas Galan says the same and talks about never having resorted to public assistance. He had rehabilitation as well. He bonded out of INS custody. He worked. He went to community college. He reported faithfully. He appeared at all hearings. So there are a lot of factors in the record that could have balanced this out, but the broader issue in stepping back is that this shows the necessity of a remand, at least on the prejudice issue. And if the court is inclined to take judicial notice of the visa bulletin information, then a remand so that we can present record evidence and contest it in a way that we were never given a chance to before, because they never raised it before. They're litigating this for the first time on appeal. I submit that that's improper and they shouldn't be allowed to do it. But if the court is going to allow that, then it should remand so that we can join issue it, as to it below. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. The matter is transmitted. And we come to number three on the calendar, U.S. versus David Andrew Gonzalez.